Now, my next guest's story is one of drugs, sex, yachts, Wall Street parties, Lamborghinis and fraud. Jordan Belfort is the Wolf of Wall Street, the inspiration behind Martin Scorsese's film of the same name. In the 1990s, Belfort was worth millions of dollars running his own stock brokerage firm, Stratton Oakmont. At the time, he was described as a twisted Robin Hood who takes from the rich and gives to himself and his merry band of brokers. In 2004, he was convicted of defrauding clients of more than $200 million. He says he still owes investors around $65 million. Here's Leonardo DiCaprio's portrayal of him in The Wolf of Wall Street.
Dad, I don't want you stressing out about any of this.
How can I not get stressed out? Look at the knuckleheads you got working for
you. I know they're knuckleheads, but I need them to want to live like me, you get it? To live like me.
Jordy, you know, one of these days, the chickens are going to come home to roost.
You're looking at me like I'm crazy.
Crazy? This is obscene.
It was obscene. In the normal world. I mean, who the wanted to live there?
Well, it seems that Jordan Belfort has changed his tune somewhat. He's now a motivational speaker and a corporate trainer. He's coming to Dublin on the 27th of May to deliver a speech in the RDS entitled The Truth Behind the Success of the Real Life Wolf of Wall Street. We caught up with him yesterday and I first asked him, was the portrayal of his wild life in the film accurate?
Yeah, well, yeah, pretty much. I mean, there was a lot of drugs, a lot of sex, a lot of debauchery, so... You know, it was just a completely wild ride. It didn't start off that way, but, you know, it was one of those things that it was a slow creep starting in 1988. And by the time, you know, a couple of years went around, it's like sort of step by step. And before you know it, you're doing things you thought you'd never do. And it all seems perfectly normal. So that's how it happened.
Just how crazy was it? I mean, what was a particularly eventful day for you?
Well, I mean, in the height of the insanity, and I would say that's maybe like 1994, I was so addicted to drugs. I'm sober 17 years now, so I can talk about this with a bit of a smile on my face. Because, you know, you're sober, you can look back and say, what the hell was I thinking, right? So on a typical day, I'd wake up at 5 a.m., 2 hours before my wife, because I wanted to get my first high of the day and before she got out of bed. So I go up and down before she even woke up, right? Then I'd, you know, go into the sauna, sweat out all the evil spirits, head over to the office, you know, kiss my kids goodbye in the morning, right? Go head over to the office. And then I would stay sober, and this is the height of the insanity. I would stay sober until lunch, go out for a two-hour lunch. And, you know, the thing with the Quaaludes is they would have a short, like, you'll up. It's not like alcohol where you end up with a hangover. You go up and down, and then you're kind of normal again. So I'd have my second high during lunch, come back, do more trading after lunch, and then give the 5 o'clock meeting. And then after that, go into the city and just go party all night and typically you know, end up with a bunch of, you know, we used to call them blue chip hookers, you know, and just go completely wild again. Then, of course, the cocaine started in, and it was just pure craziness. And I usually was like 8 or 10 guys together on a typical night. And then, you know, once a week we'd have, you know, 30 or 40. And then every month you'd have a full get together with a few thousand. So that was the culture.
How much money were you making at the peak?
I was making a million a week in cash, but I was making a lot more than that in terms of paper profits. You know, in other words, I was taking companies public every 3 or 4 weeks and, you know, had inside stakes and stuff. So on paper, I was making a lot more, but the cash flow was enormous. So that was going on for a while.
How much of that money, that million a week and the paper profits, how much of that was legitimate legal trading activity and how much of it was illegal and fraudulent?
Good question. Listen, here's the deal. It's an interesting, you know, thing you hit on, because 95% of my company was legit. Only 5% was fraudulent. However, the profits from the fraudulent stuff probably was 30% or 40% of the overall. So it was definitely that, you know, there was a lucrative thing that I was doing wrong. And frankly, you know, it wasn't just me. Everyone on Wall Street was doing it. But that does not make it right. That's why I rationalized at the time. But I don't think that makes it any less bad. So I'm not trying to say, oh, everyone was doing it. It's not a cop-out. But that, at the time, if you want to know my rationalization, I was like, well, everyone's doing it, you know, blah, 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 and so forth. So I would say, and that's the saddest part of all, is if I wouldn't have done the criminal aspect of it, that 5%, I would have ended up making billions upon billions of dollars more.
And why did you do it, do you think? Why did you drift onto the wrong side?
Bad mentors is one part of it. I had the wrong people whispering in my ear. Greed was another aspect of it in the beginning. Desire for instant gratification. And, you know, that's a lethal combination for a young guy. He was, you know, if you remember the time, it was right when, you know, Gordon Gekko was, you know, on screen saying greed is good. Greed cuts through. Greed clarifies. He looked pretty good on stage. Nice expensive suit, private jet. And a lot of Wall Street is not just myself, you know, bought into that insanity because it is insane because greed is not good. It's ambition that's good. Passion that's good.
Some of the investigators who pursued you have, you know, emphasized a very different side to it, I suppose. One former assistant U.S. attorney, Joel Cohn, said this is a guy who woke up every day, 7 days a week for many years and said, what crimes can I commit today? And that you, you know, set about to rip people off every day is his version of it.
Right. Well, you know, Joel Cohn, in my opinion, is an a-hole, okay, who wants his 15 minutes of fame right now. I would suggest you talk to Dan Alonzo, who was the guy who really knew me. He was the U.S. attorney that I worked with for 5 years. So Joel Cohn is not someone who I respect or someone whose opinion I value.
How do you feel about the question of victims? And that was some of the controversy over the film, that, you know, a lot of people did lose a lot of money. Do you have a sense of guilt and remorse about that?
Excuse me?
Do you feel a sense of guilt or remorse about that?
Well, not guilt, remorse. See, guilt is a very destructive emotion, and it's really a self-serving emotion. But for me, it's about remorse, and that means actually righting the wrongs. This year, I'm hoping to pay back 100% of all the losses. I've paid back a ton of money already, and I just announced a speaking tour in the United States to be about 40 cities, in which I'll make about $50 million. And I've announced I'm turning over 100% of all profits to investors. Between that, I also turned over the book royalties, so I think everyone's going to get paid back this year. So I think that's my definition of true remorse, where you, instead of saying, oh, my God, I feel so guilty, you do something about it.
Have you ever met any of them or said sorry to them?
Well, I haven't met them. I don't think it's my place, and I've been asked that before, and so you probably already know the answer, which is no, I haven't met any, but not because I wouldn't. Simply, I don't think it's my place to seek people out, you know, who maybe don't even want to think about it anymore. I think the best gift I can give those people versus an apology is, let me pay you back. And then with that, it'll become nice, I'm sorry, I hope you can forgive me now after they've been paid back. That's my goal, is to pay everyone back. And my goal is to do it this year, not in 10 years.
But if you look at it, did you end up ripping off the little guy in a lot of those cases?
No, it was wealthy people. That was the list. The whole idea of the firm, the niche I found was calling the wealthiest 1% of Americans. That was the whole idea. And in the beginning, when it first started, we were calling average moms and pops, and you sell them a little bit of stock. The breakthrough I made was by teaching these young guys how to sound so good on the phone and how to be such expert closers, they were now able to call the wealthiest business owners in America. That's who we were calling. And it was we purchased a list of them. The reason I know I was calling because we paid for a list of the wealthiest 1%. That was an expensive list. That's what we marketed to.
When you were under pressure from the investigators and the police, you eventually decided that, you know, you would cooperate with them and you assisted them in getting prosecutions against others. Do you have any regrets about that or any mixed feelings about it? Do you think you betrayed them?
Many mixed feelings. I mean, listen, if you recall from the movie, the movie's somewhat fictionalized, because they want me to rat out a friend of mine, and I couldn't do it. And I passed the guy a note saying, don't incriminate yourself. And they fictionalized it because it wasn't Danny, it was someone else I passed the note to. But in my mind, that was the right thing to do. Unfortunately, the guy turned around and then ratted me out and said I passed him a note. I got in trouble and ratted me out, and I actually did an extra 6 months in jail for that. So in the end, you know, it was a terribly complicated time, awful time in my life. I had mixed emotions about it the whole way through, and that was really my way of coming to terms with it. I'll give them information, but I wouldn't rat out my mate, and that was really my way of balancing it. In retrospect, it was a stupid thing to do, so I could have gotten an extra 20 years. So, but I did that because I just couldn't look my friend in the eye and do it. So, I mean, that was the decision I made.
Were Wall Street guys like yourself ultimately the cause of the global financial crash? And what I mean is, you know, you were involved in it long before that, but was it the same traits, the same motivations, the same idea of greed that actually produced the global crash in your view?
Absolutely. It was. And, that's a very good point in the sense that it's a mindset. And it starts you know, and greed is sort of like an all-encompassing thing, but it really more is about this idea that, you know, you have a fiduciary responsibility to your clients to put them first, and that just went completely out the window in the GFC. It was all about, you know, making deals and structuring products that you could simply make commissions on and so forth. And it was a terrible thing that happened, but it was, again, it was a creep. You know, if you look at the seeds of the financial crisis, it was so far before it in terms of this, you know, the way, you know, the trade-off between government and Wall Street, where people at Goldman Sachs then go to work for the government, they loosen up the restrictions, change the laws, create loopholes for their buddies on Wall Street to jump through, and they go back into private practice and get rich again. You know, I mean, it's completely insane, that revolving door. And that essentially opened up the window, and at the same time, you had, you know, this sort of greed-fueled environment that was being compensated. Those brokers were being compensated on profits from short-term transactions. And very often, transactions that yield short-term profits don't yield long-term profits. So that was the mistake, that people could generate quick money, but there was no value being created. And that's what really was the essence of the crisis.
What would you say was, you once said that the most important things in your life in the past, I think, were money, power, sex, and drugs. What would they be now?
Key value. You've done your research. Now would be, number one is giving value. Well, number one is my family. Two is giving value. Three is charity. And I don't even have making money on the list because, frankly, making money is so easy.
Oh, come on now, Jordan. This sounds like far too big a transformation. This is a complete transplant, personality transplant. You sound like
a
saint now.
You're missing my point. Let me finish for a second, okay? I love money. I love it. I love to spend it. I love to make it. So, of course, I'm not saying I love money. I love money. I love private planes. I love yachts. I love expensive clothes like anybody else does. I probably even more. Part of who I am. But it's not a value that I chase.
Well, Jordan Belfort, the former Wolf of Wall Street, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.